This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Promises, promises. All politicians make them. Sometimes they're very vague, promises of a better this or a brighter that. But sometimes they get very specific, like George Bush Sr. in 1988.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no. And they'll push, and I'll say no. And they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes.
They weren't cheering later. That broken promise led directly to his loss in 1992 to Bill Clinton, who then promised he'd remake our healthcare system. That, of course, didn't happen, but it seemed at the time more like a political miscalculation than a broken promise. Actual healthcare reform didn't happen until Barack Obama pushed it through, but in touting his plan, he made promises about Obamacare that he just couldn't keep.
No matter how we reform healthcare, we will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor, period. If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan, period.
That was not so much a period at the end, more an ellipsis. That broken promise led to more public grumbling about the law, costly attempts to fix the problem, and provided a bit more fuel for Republican opposition. Then earlier this year, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy made a pledge, or was it more of a plan, during his State of the State address.
If the people of Connecticut are going to share in the sacrifice during tough times, they should also share in the recovery as things begin to turn around. Together, we can issue a targeted refund to Connecticut taxpayers to return to them some of the sales taxes and gas taxes that they've paid. A refund of $110 for families and $55 for individuals will help offset the payments they've made towards those two taxes.
When smaller-than-expected tax revenues cut into a surplus, Malloy had to abandon the rebate. Now that the 2014 campaign is fully underway, it remains to be seen if voters will hold it against him. But these instances raise a big question. Why make promises you know you might not be able to keep, especially in a political environment where no one person holds so much power they can always get what they want? And what's the impact of a broken political promise? Do voters really hold it against a candidate? Today, Where We Live, the art and science of the political promise, we want to hear from you. Do you believe politicians who promise something? Do you think the promise is just part of the political process? Join us with your thoughts. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. Coming up, we'll hear from one of Bill Clinton's speechwriters, and we'll take a look inside behavioral economics. It might give us some insight about how people act when something they think they have is taken away from them. But I want to welcome in Scott McLean, who's a professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Scott, good to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, John. It's great to be here.
Before we get into some of the history, let's talk about this Malloy pledge, or maybe it's a plan that he makes. He tells us he's going to give us all a $55 tax rebate, and then, well, things don't happen quite like he hoped, and he has to come back a couple months later and say it's off the table. Does this really matter?
It's a difficult question because there's always two people. There's the promiser and the promisee, and one should always keep one's promises. But there are situations where you can be excused for breaking a promise. When situations change, when something unexpected happens, when the promisee changes what they actually want you to do. One of the things that's interesting about politics is when politicians make promises, they're not just promising to you as an individual, they're promising to a lot of people, large groups of voters or the entire state. Governor Malloy was in a context of making a promise to an entire state. So in the end, whether it hurts Malloy or whether it matters or whether people are willing to excuse him for breaking this promise or look at mitigating factors, it's up to the individual voter to decide that.
There was a poll from Quinnipiac University, their polling institute, before that pledge was broken, and he was running about neck and neck with Tom Foley. And then there was just another recent poll, and he was at about the same point. It seems, as of right now, to have not hurt him. Of course, there hasn't really been any campaigning around it. Do you think this is something that could hurt Dan Malloy?
Absolutely. But again, it's a question for the voters. Political promises are different from the everyday kind of promises we make. We break promises all the time, Mark Twain is famous for saying, you know, better a broken promise than no promise at all. And it's especially true for politicians. But politicians make promises in packages. We call them party platforms. We call them, in Malloy's case, a state of the state address. So when voters evaluate a candidate or say if they trust them or they're reliable, they don't just look at one promise. They have to take into account the whole picture. The problem is there are these really memorable promises that are made, like the Read My Lips pledge that Bush made in 1988, that people remember, or that the opposition will continually remind them of, or the media will remind them of. And those are factors that you just can't say on a radio show that this will hurt that politician. It really depends on how we play this game out.
You know, and we're going to be talking about political rhetoric and speech writing in just a moment, but that Twain quote makes me think about the idea of promise being kind of a two-edged sword. A promise is something that I might make to you. I'm going to show up on time for our dinner date. But promise is also, it's a bigger thing. It's like the word hope. I have promise. I feel as though something good will happen. And in that context, promise is a positive. Even if you're not able to follow through with everything you say you're going to do, it gives people some sort of hope.
Right. Well, it's a promise is a special kind of moral action or a kind of a speech act, as John Austin, the famous legal philosopher, once said. It's a speech act that creates an expectation in the promisee. So violating a promise is always something that the promisee doesn't like. It violates an expectation. It's tantamount to deceiving that person. It's not right to break a promise. But we also have to remember there are two parties that the promisee can forgive, can excuse the breaker of the promise. So if you didn't show up for dinner at our dinner date on time or at all, you could say, well, one of my kids got sick and we had to rush to the hospital. I'm not going to hold – you did break your promise, but I'm going to forgive you for that.
We're talking with Scott McLean. He's a professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. We're talking about political promises kept and broken today. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. We're going to get to some of your thoughts about this particular broken political promise by Governor Dan Malloy, if it means anything to you, but also other political promises. But I want to bring in Paul Orsulak, who's a former speechwriter for President Clinton and Vice President Gore. He serves as founder of West Wing Writers. He joins us from the headquarters of NPR in Washington, D.C. today. Paul, welcome to our show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you can pick up on that thread of the idea of promise is a kind of a two-edged sword in the speechwriting world. Promise is something that you don't want to get out, you know, over your skis on. You don't want to promise more than you can actually deliver, but you don't want to have a candidate who holds no promise, right?
That's true. I would say that, you know, just as there are two kinds of the promiser and the promisee, there are really three kinds of promises, especially in politics. There are those that involve money or your pocketbook. I'll raise, you know, the George Bush, I won't raise taxes, or the governor's, I'll give you a rebate. There are life and death promises, which are, I'm going to bring these troops home. Lyndon Johnson suffered from it. President Obama promised to bring troops home from Afghanistan and Iraq. The third are everything else. You know, people tend to notice the first two more than anything, and especially in bad economic times. You know, it's no accident that the Read My Lips, No New Promises was such a big deal. We had a bad recession in the early 90s. The promise now, the recession, you know, the economy's a little better than it was, but it's not great. So people tend to remember those promises that affect their pocketbook more than anything else. And if you get too far out ahead of yourself, you know, politicians just invite the scorn of voters if they're not able to see them through.
They invite the scorn of voters, but they also invite, in the very politicized world we live in, a lot of ammunition from the other side. So when you make a promise, everyone else is ready to pounce, right? And that promise is going to be something that's going to be used against you in political ads and on the floor of the Congress and every other place.
Well, it's the unfortunate environment that we're living in, but it's true. You know, in the same way that speechwriters now try to limit any soundbite to 140 characters or they're tweetable through Twitter at the end of the day, which is a new development. You read any you're taught declarative sentences are what make political speeches, but declarative sentences also sound like promises. And, you know, I can't tell you how often national policy was made because a speechwriter at 11 p.m. for an event the next day decided to turn a 3-point plan into a 5-point plan and had some declarative sentence somewhere that somebody will read and hold you accountable to later. It's the age that we live in that you have to read everything for its failure, not its success. If this doesn't happen, how badly will it hurt us?
Scott, you want to pick up on that?
Well, I think that one of the common perceptions is that you should never make too many promises. But promise is what allows us to govern. Promise is what allows people to bind themselves together to run a campaign or govern or do anything in democratic public life in our country or any democratic regime. So I think it's especially true that there are actually incentives built into the democratic political process that make it necessary to overpromise. And I think part of what's not being raised enough is the fact that politicians do overpromise, but they have to. They have to overpromise what they can deliver. One reason is the declarative sentence idea that sounds a lot like promises. But, you know, would you follow a politician who said, well, maybe we'll think and talk and educate the public about the need for health care, and then maybe I'd be willing to wiggle on, the employer mandate or the individual mandate? You can't start the conversation that way in politics. You have to start with a promise.
Well, and Paul, or it's like our producers just pointed out to me, the language in Dan Malloy's State of the State address is we can give a $55 rebate, not we will. And that's, I think, a little bit of what Scott's talking about here. The real declarative statement, we will do this, opens yourself up to a broken promise. The less declarative statement may not sound as strong, but it certainly does give you a lot of cover if it's not able to happen.
Truthfully, voters kind of hate that because, you know, what you say and what they hear are two different things. I mean, it's parsing what the definition of is, if you recall our political history. The problem with political promises is twofold. One is that if a lot of times, you know, new candidates for office will make promises and then get in and realize, gosh, things are a lot worse than we said they were. I mean, you know, John F. Kennedy's famous line about Dwight Eisenhower saying that we got in and turned out that everything we were saying was true, and we were really surprised to see that. But the problem with promises is – and promises and governing are two different things. And political promises are goals. The reality of governing means sometimes you're not going to be able to see those through for whatever reason if tax revenue isn't enough. Voters don't really give you that kind of license and you know our experience is that if you own up to that promise and you're very honest about it, it's better than running around pretending that you never made it. You know, if you say, you know, we intended to do this, facts on the ground have changed and we're not going to be able to, and you know, that's my fault. I take responsibility for that. People are more inclined to give you the benefit of the judgment than if you say, well, I didn't actually say will. I said are, and you know.
Well, this whole idea of taking responsibility for saying something that maybe you're not able to follow through, that's another whole part of this discussion I think I want to try to get to. A few quick phone calls before we take a break. Dan's in Wallingford. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
And you've highlighted exactly what I want to focus on. With the fact of the governor making the promise and then having to rescind that promise, the time frame between the two seem to be a lot shorter than you often see other broken promises from politicians. And what that suggests to me is a very clear lack of understanding of the current situation. And I feel like the governor was simply just trying to get an approval bump in ratings and never really focused on what he was dealing with at hand. And I know that can probably be summarized for most broken promises, but it's quite disturbing that the short amount of time between the two and the fact that his comment about it was almost he threw his hands up in the air like, oh, well, nothing I can do about it. I think, you know, and I voted for the governor, and I was very disheartened by his whole attitude towards the quote-unquote change that occurred that led to him not being able to fulfill his promise. Thank you.
Dan, thank you very much for that. And Scott, you were nodding your head at that. It really is true. When George Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes, it's not like he got elected the next day and then went around raising taxes. It took quite some time. In part, the time it took is one of the reasons why he lost to Bill Clinton. It was an evolving process over 4 years. Dan, the caller, is talking about a very short period of time between a promise kept and then a promise broken.
Yeah, I don't know how to factor in the amount of time that passes. That's really a difficult thing to do. Again, it's, you know, if the caller thinks that's too short a time, that's for him. Others will say it's good that he didn't follow through on that promise because it was a dumb promise in the first place. It really depends on your point of view. But I mean, going back to the Bush thing is a really good example of how promises work or don't work in politics. Bush made that pledge, if you recall, at the 1988 Republican convention. He was being pressured on the right to really hold down taxes. They were suspicious that Bush would be easily rolled by the Democrats and that he would be someone who would raise taxes because in the past, Bush had said, I'm very pragmatic, and he'd done pragmatic things. Bush was simply trying to communicate to his audience, which was the Republican voters, that these were his principles. He was going to resist raising taxes as much as possible. That he used the rhetoric of "read my lips, no new taxes," added actual force to this promise and made it believable. The problem that he faced is that he did resist raising taxes. He resisted it all the way through for that very, very long time until the end when facing a Democratic Congress and the prospect of ballooning deficits, he decided that the right thing to do for the American people would be to allow the Democrats to raise taxes. And yet he is the one that we remember being blamed for that.
We have to take a break. When we come back, joining our conversation will be Dean Carlin, who's a professor of economics at Yale University, who's done work on these very issues. We'll be talking about behavioral economics and how people actually react when somebody says, I'll give you something, and then you have to take it back. We'll take your phone calls as well, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive@wnpr.org or tweet us at wherelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Well, the political season is certainly underway, so we're talking about political promises made and political promises kept, some broken. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Joining us is Scott McLean, who's a professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Paul Orzelak joins us from Washington today. He's a former speechwriter for President Clinton and Vice President Gore. He serves as founder of West Wing Writers. I want to bring in by phone Dean Carlin, who's a professor of economics at Yale University, who follows the way people react to things all the time. He works in behavioral economics. And Dean, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So first of all, you've been listening into the first part of our conversation. I wonder what parts of the political promise game really resonate with you as an economist.
So I think the key is whether people really believe the promises, I think, is the heart of some of this. And, you know, this goes right to the question that you alluded to about loss aversion. So for loss aversion to kick in, it has to be that you really feel ownership over something. And so the real question is when these promises are made, and as you were talking earlier about kind of the wordsmithing of whether they said will or can, I mean, these are details I couldn't agree more with what was said, that this type of rhetoric and argumentation is what the public hates. Ultimately, it's what is said is not always exactly what is believed. And the question really is, if some vague statement was made about $55 going to into a tax rebate, are people really, really internalizing that? Are they really saying to themselves, I own $55 now, and where when we take that away, it's deemed as some great loss? And you know, my instinct is that no, that this is not something that was fully internalized in the minds of the voters.
And maybe because of that short time frame we talked about, but maybe you can explain for our listeners the idea of loss aversion. We thought about calling you around this because it was something that resonated with me a bit. Whenever somebody promises anything to me, I mentally bank it. I say, okay, I've got 55 extra dollars than I had before, and so it's mine now. And the world of loss aversion really works on that idea that if I have something, I'm gonna think about it differently than if it's something that I could potentially gain in the future. Maybe you can explain loss aversion to us.
So the basic idea is that we value the things that we have more than the things that we don't have. And so take it as a very simple example. You know, how hard would you fight to avoid losing $55 versus how hard would you fight And by fight, I don't mean physically. I just mean, you know, would you strive and go out of your way for to gain $55? And the idea is that a lot of people would go through more effort and or get to avoid losing $55 than they would to gain $55. But the reality is that it doesn't always work, right? I mean, context matters. So we have this basic principle of loss aversion, and there's lots of contexts in which it does seem to bear fruit. But we've also done tests where we thought it was going to work, and it didn't. And it turned out it didn't matter when we described things as losses to people versus gains. So as an example, we did some experiments with reminding people to save. And so they have something that they're saving for, and we sent off some text messages to remind people, hey, you know, you need to make all your payments and make all your deposits into this account in order to get that thing that you're saving for. Or in one case, it was about a reward. You know, you need to make all of these deposits in order to get that reward. In another treatment, we did the loss treatment. We said, hey, you know, if you don't make all your payments, you're going to lose that reward. And you don't want to lose that reward. And it just didn't matter. It did matter to get these messages, right? The messages actually increased saving. So there was something about the message that did inspire people to save. So, you know, but there's other contexts where we've seen examples where the loss aversion does work. So, one lesson of behavioral economics is that context does matter. It doesn't mean that when saying context matters, it doesn't mean that it's all random and we never know what's going to happen. But it does mean that it's not a simple rule of saying, you know, when loss aversion is relevant, people will react more strongly.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Jeff in Prospect. Hello, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Just want a couple things. I think you're talking about promise and its significance. I think we should take the promises in context in terms of how significant that promise is, and if an individual has, you know, responded to hundreds of things and there's one promise, in this case, I would consider insignificant. I think that has to come into play. And then the second part is, if someone makes a promise, I think we generally as people hold them accountable only for the things that they have control over. So if I make a promise it's not going to rain tomorrow and it rains, that's really not in my control. And I think most people understand that the taxes are done by the legislature. So that's my comment.
Well, Jeff, you raise a couple interesting points. First, I want to ask Dean Carlin that idea. When it comes to how people react to losses, I would assume small versus large is a big deal. So if I have the potential of losing $5, and that doesn't mean that much to me, I may react differently than if all of a sudden the loss is like $50,000, all of my money, right?
No, that's absolutely true. But it's also true on the gain side, right? But there is an old gambler's fallacy, which is appropriate here, where it's a lot of people, if you're in the loss zone, if you're at the casino or doing something, might take on heavier risks to get back to zero. Right, even if it's small little losses, so there is an asymmetry that does tend to exist. Whereas if you have a small amount of gains, you don't see people all of a sudden taking on more risk. There is true, but as you said, I mean, it kind of goes without saying that people do respond to price, and you know, if the amount of money is bigger, then people will react more.
Paul Orselak, the other thing that our caller raises that I'd love to have you comment on is maybe about how our political speech might be changing in what we can, I think, all agree is a broken political system. Nobody thinks that the president or the governor of any state is going to have control over everything that gets done. He can make all the promises he wants, but we understand certainly the president isn't going to be able to get anything through Congress. Do you think it changes the way we talk about promises made when we know that we can always blame the other for not getting it done?
Not the first time. I would say the first time around, you're as bold as you can be. During the 2012 campaign, PolitiFact.com tracked more than 500 promises that President Obama had made during the 2008 campaign. They found that he'd kept 161 of them, had some compromised version of about 50, and that he'd been rebuffed by Congress on 239 of his promises. In only 56 cases did they find that he actually had broken a promise. But, you know, the interesting thing about loss aversion is that in a political context, it sort of sits on the dividing line between positive and negative campaigning. And it comes back to this issue of control where, You know, it's a difference to say, I will create jobs or I will stop that other person from sending jobs overseas. And if you remember back to the way that President Obama's campaign defined Mitt Romney in the early part of 2012 by really talking about his corporate history and the jobs that had been lost and jobs that had been sent overseas, it really turned to a loss aversion. I'm going to prevent him from taking these things from you, from what we've done. And then the control issue has been at the heart of every presidential campaign, going back to Harry Truman's campaign against the Do-Nothing Congress in 1948, which, you know, frankly, this Congress has a record about 10% of that. So it's historically worse than ever. But, you know, in a country where our swing districts have gone from 103 in 1992, according to Nate Silver, to about 25 today, and that the sort of the landslide district.
We just lost Paul Orsulak, I think, mid-sentence, and we'll try to reestablish a line with him. We're talking with Paul Orsulak, who's a former speechwriter for President Clinton and Vice President Gore, also with Dean Carlin, who's a professor of economics at Yale University. And Scott McLean joins us in studio. He's a professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. We're talking about political promises here on the program. Scott, you want to jump in quickly?
Yeah, I thought what Jeff, the last caller, had to say was really remarkable, actually. And I thought what he was saying— or at least the part that I'm leaping onto here, is that there is, in a lot of people's mind, the difference between a fundamental promise or, basic foundational promise and a marginal promise. Part of what happens in politics, though, is that the electorate and the public is broken into various smaller groups. So what might be a marginal promise for one group might be very fundamental to another one. And what makes a promise fundamental is not the promise itself, but how does the promisee group react when that promise that they perceived as important was not kept? So case in point, President Obama's proposal for the DREAM Act to find a legal way of giving undocumented immigrant children a chance to get a job and get them into the system and so on. Well, that failed. That was a promise. It failed. And then President Obama sort of wiped his hands. But there were groups called Dreamers who organized and got active, and they held President Obama's feet to the fire. There's a famous meeting where he met with these people to tell them why he couldn't do anything about this. And their retort, their chant was, yes, you can, yes, you can, yes, you can. And it eventually led to President Obama passing an executive order that enacted many of the features of the DREAM Act, allowing undocumented young people to get scholarships, not be immediately deported, and so on.
I want to get to some more phone calls here because a lot of people want to join our conversation. Sandy in Farmington, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good, what's up?
Building on the commentary about how significant the promise is and whether or not you believe the promise, I do think there's a difference between promises made by candidates for office versus elected officials, and that when you're a candidate for office, you may not have full information. And so I think that means that you should be very cautious about the promises you make, knowing that you may not have the full information about whether you can live up to that promise. But I think that voters may be more willing to forgive a candidate if they realize that the reason that the promise was broken was because the then elected official didn't have control over that situation. But in the same vein, an elected official, I think, really should be charged with having that full information and knowing whether or not that promise can be delivered upon or not. As far as Governor Malloy's promise, I would agree with the comments as far as it being a really a marginal promise, in my opinion, and frankly, I think probably would cost more to administer the $55 refund, making it not very sensible.
Well, Sandy, thank you very much for that. Scott?
Sandy, that's a really great comment. The thing that is really important to remember here is that we do tend to make the distinction that Sandy makes between a campaign promise and promised by an elected official at state of the state or wherever. Here's the problem in American political life right now, that the campaign mode of making promises and being angry when those promises are not kept is filtering into the governing process. So it's extremely difficult to compromise when everybody has to make promises in a campaign, necessarily so. And my theory is really that they have to overpromise in a campaign. But then it comes time to governing, and nobody can compromise. So, you know, this is why we're having trouble with moving a lot of bills through Congress. It doesn't happen in Connecticut because it's one party control. But in Congress, neither side can afford to let their followers believe that they broke a promise. This is really the corner that the Republicans have painted themselves in Congress right now, is that if they do compromise with the president, they are going to get primaried by very, very angry people that are going to say, you sold us out. We are going to run a Tea Party candidate who's even more committed than you are to these promises that we want.
Dean Carlin, I'm wondering if it matters that politics seems to have increasingly become a not trustworthy environment. When I was talking earlier with Scott about, you know, breaking a promise to a friend about going to dinner, it's a trusting relationship. You may break trust for a reason at a time, but in essence, it is a relationship built on trust. It seems that increasingly the politician's relationship with voters and citizens is very untrustworthy. Does that matter in this relationship, do you think, that people really can't trust each other inherently?
Well, I mean, there's two. I mean, it depends on the claims made, but there's clearly an element here where one needs to either trust judgment or trust the actual, you know, exact spoken promise. And so the question is, do you trust someone's judgment to say, wait a second, yes, I said that, and now we have better information, and so now I have a better plan. And, you know, people have their prior opinions, and they will tend to see the evidence in front of them and let that reinforce their prior opinion. So if someone is, if someone trusts Malloy in the very beginning, then they trust the judgment and they say, aha, you made a promise, you got better information, you used your judgment, I trust your judgment, and off you go to a new decision. And of course, if someone is predisposed against Malloy, then they see this as breaking a promise. And that just seems, that's the nature of how we all distort information that is given to us to reinforce our views. And that, I think, is, you know, ultimately my hunch here, though, is that this, like, I think the last speaker, I mean, the last caller made reference to this, is that, you know, we're not talking about a big amount of money here in terms of people's lives. There's other things, that other policies that probably have a bigger impact. And so, and, you know, I suspect that no one is seeing this as a great act of mistrust by any means. Even the people who are opposed to Malloy are not seeing this in that kind of hugely detrimental kind of way.
Even at the time, we talked about it in terms of it's basically a tank of gas. That's what we're talking about here over the course of a year. Michelle's in Vernon. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Really enjoy the show.
Yeah.
I guess listening to this conversation, my thought is I really don't trust any of the, quote, promises that politicians made, whether they're in office or running for office, because bottom line, the way I look at it is there are so many different factors that play in the government. It's a very bipartisan, you know, situation. So a politician can, you know, can say they're going to do one thing, but what they really have control over, to me, is very limited. So what I look at in a politician is how closely their beliefs align with mine and what they're going to try to do. Do I believe that they're going to try and do that, and do I trust them to do that? Not whether I trust that they can actually do, you know, the one thing that they promised or five things that they promised, because that's just unrealistic in my mind. So I take promises with a grain of salt. I look at their overall performance. So when I saw that in the paper about Malloy, I said, we'll see what happens. And then when it was recent, I said, no surprise, you know. Thanks for taking the call.
Hey, thank you very much. And quickly, let's go to Charlie in Storrs before we move on. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Following up with the previous caller just said, I think there might be a kind of cynical negativity of the elector or the votership that views all promises as kind of sort of promise resistance, that we're aware of the overpromising and our shifting expectations make it so that we expect promises to be broken rather than kept. I think maybe not the purpose, but one of the effects of promises these days is for the opposition to point at promises as they are broken, as opposed to someone who supports a candidate saying, oh, that promise was kept. We'll look at the opposing candidate and say that promise was not kept.
Well, first of all, Charlie, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I think Paul Orszalak is back with us from NPR in Washington, and we're going to talk a little bit in a little bit about how President Clinton actually worked against the Bush no new taxes promise. But I have been struck by this idea that so many state of the states and states of the union are long lists of essentially promises. We talked about this earlier, and I'm wondering about that, about this technique, Paul, of writing what is essentially a long laundry list of things I hope to do, because it does provide that ammunition. A lot of these things aren't going to get done. What's the calculus there for that laundry list that happens during most states of the union?
Well, the value that, you know, whatever a president wants to get done and what he can get done was on trial this year, right? I mean, when the walk-in music for President Obama's State of the Union this year might as well have been changed from the Hail to the Chief to With or Without You, where he came in and, you know, he said, look, all these things need to get done. I've been talking about these for 6 years. We were able to do some of them. Before I cut out earlier, I was saying that there was a study done of the president's promises from the 2008 campaign, and he found that of the 500 or so promises, that 239 were rebuffed or stalled by Congress. And, you know, some of these things go back for decades. They're promising, you know, the issue of equal pay has been talked about for more than 60 years. Until President Obama was able to pass Obamacare, every president for more than 70 years has talked about passing health reform. It's a goal, and just because Congress won't get it done doesn't necessarily mean that you don't talk about it, but it does eventually become this long laundry list. I mean, I remember Senator Dodd once said to me in a conversation that the big change in his career was that for the first 15 or 20 years, he would go out and give speeches and then go to Congress and pass those things, and then they would become law. And what he found was that he kept giving the same speeches over and over again at some point in the 90s, and the numbers would change, the numbers would get bigger, but the applause lines would still be the same because Congress would never act on things. I think we're at a divided political time. We're at a time where, you know, the number of safe seats has more than doubled over the last 20 years, and people don't have the necessary incentive to compromise. In fact, it's in, especially on the right, it's a negative incentive that if you do compromise in any way, you're going to be primaried by somebody who isn't going to compromise. So, you know, the idea that a president has any control over the ultimate fate of his agenda, and, you know, studies have shown that 75% of promises made by presidents up through Ronald Reagan were kept. The intention is there, and a lot of times the first time around you promise all the things you're going to do. The second time around you assail the Congress for not passing these things, and the third time around you really make the case that okay, well, I without Congress this is what we're going to be able to do. But you know whether I mean I think the test of presidents, especially and governors, have changed. It's no longer good enough to say, well, Congress blocked all these things and you need to give me a new Congress. People say, well, we elected you to figure out how to get through and make compromise to actually get things done. But we're at such a broken time right now that even promises kept are cause for elections.
We have to take a break in a moment, but before I let Dean Carlin go, since Paul just mentioned incentives for compromise, I thought I'd let you chime in on that, because that's really one of the things that happens here is over time in this broken political system, we try to figure out, are our politicians actually going to move to compromise? Are they going to move to change over time? What are the incentives that they have to do this? I wonder if you have any thoughts about what Paul just said.
Not really. I mean, just nothing deep.
nothing deep.
No.
Dean Carlin's a professor of economics at Yale University. Paul Orszalak, a former speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore and President Clinton. Scott McLean's a professor of political science at Quinnipiac. When we come back, more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. More emails, wherewelive at WNPR.org. And more of your tweets at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, be honest, is there an animal that's cooler than a turtle? Pokey and deliberate on land, but swift and graceful underwater. They're housed in a hard shell, but yet they're related to the birds. Yes, we'll look at some new Yale research on turtles that might surprise you. We'll find out a bit more about how these sometimes friendly and sometimes snappy ground-hugging reptiles are faring in our state. a bit of turtle talk tomorrow on Where We Live. Today we're talking about political promises made, some kept, some broken, with Scott McLean from Quinnipiac University, Paul Orsalak, who's a former speechwriter for President Clinton and Vice President Gore, and also Dean Carlin, who's a behavioral economist at Yale University. We're taking your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. And some of your emails, including this one from Steve: what about negative promises like a Lieberman or Malloy being elected as a Democrat and then taking positions that are center or center-right, like Malloy on education or Lieberman on the Iraq War? Well, Paul, you've worked with Senator Lieberman, and you've worked with a few Democrats who've been accused of this very thing. What do you say to Steve, our emailer?
Well, I actually worked for Senator Lieberman in the 2000 campaign. I was his speechwriter when he was the vice presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. Of course, I grew up in Connecticut. I grew up in northeastern Connecticut and went to UConn, so I knew him and knew that, you know, he had occasionally moved to the right on issues. I actually think that Senator Lieberman, his move to the right on the war was I respected it, even though I didn't agree with it, because it came from a principled place. It came from his, you know, his perception that the world was changing in a way that needed to be confronted. He saw the 9/11 and the aftermath as the biggest challenge the country faced going forward. And I think it was true to himself to do what he did. Now, going to speak at the Republican convention after that, I'm not sure I agreed with that. But, you know, a lot of politicians, the thing about politics is that we hold politicians to promises, but then we never give them license, especially now in the age of social media, to be human, to change their minds, to evolve their positions on things. And, you know, I'm not sure we want politicians and leaders who aren't willing to change the way they feel about things based on new evidence, based on changing factors. You know, I think that we want leaders who use their judgment to make better decisions, to say, you know, I wasn't right about this, even if I'm going to have to live with the consequences.
That is a really interesting point, Scott, and I think it's something we always ask for in our politicians, the ability to say I was wrong, the ability to adapt, and then we come out and we just go after them if they ever do that very thing we want them to do.
Yeah, and I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy, and the callers have sort of tried to make this important distinction out there between trust and trusting judgment. But the old-fashioned way of thinking about it is faith. We are a society that depends on trust. It's a very transactional idea that trust is something that is lost if you fail to do certain actions, if you don't follow through on everything that your word says. Faith is a really old-fashioned idea. In fact, we express faith in people when they do violate our expectations, as when you say to your kid, I still have faith in you. Or your wife, who might have, or husband, who may have done something that is an indiscretion of some kind. I still have faith in you. It is funny too. You know, PolitiFact is got this great website where they look at all the promises of Republicans and President Obama. Both parties come out pretty well. I mean, President Obama is around 65% if you throw in the ones where he had to compromise a little, and the Republicans are about the same. That's actually better odds than you have when you get married. Half of marriages end in divorce. There's a promise. Half of them get broken. The politicians are doing better than that, right?
Let's go to Tom in Granby. Hi there, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to, I guess, contribute to the conversation, I guess, the media landscape. I'm only 26, so I, you know, haven't necessarily been able to look at this objectively. But at least when I look at sort of local news broadcasts in the 70s and 80s, there's a lot higher respect for politicians than there is today. You regularly see, you know, people on local news in Connecticut here, at least, WMTR notwithstanding, who seem to be entirely intent on dragging any and every politician through the mud for any mistake and any broken promise.
Well, I think that you are onto something there, Tom. I think that there's a chance, though, Paul Orsalak, that we're maybe making a little bit too much of that. I mean, back when you were writing speeches for President Clinton or Vice President Gore, I mean, the media landscape was pretty rough and tumble. It's a little bit different today because of all the 24-hour news channels and all of the time we have to fill up with, you know, political talking head programs. Do you think Tom's right about this?
Yes. I think that we have... you know, our memories of promises in the 70s were We heard them on, you know, in campaign speeches. We may have tuned in to watch them at a convention. We may have seen them during a debate. But our ability to actually watch politicians and what they had to say was so much more limited. Today, you can, on any device, you can watch almost every speech that's recorded on YouTube. Social media creates an instant, you know, echo chamber around issues. In the days when John F. Kennedy's administration could wait 2 weeks to tell the public about the about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I mean, the news cycles have been so compressed that we get situations like Benghazi, where the Obama administration reacted because people were demanding an answer before we had all the facts on the ground. You answer as you can when you have, with whatever facts you have, but when those facts change, people are held accountable for lying. It's just an entirely different environment now. My first political promise was that I remember and that I tracked when I was in junior high was when Ronald Reagan promised to bring the hostages home from Iran. I remember, you know, that was stated every day, but I couldn't tell you all the other promises he'd made on that campaign. I just remember that one because it was so high profile, even though we didn't have social media because it was an urgent national crisis. Today, every single thing a politician says is recorded, you know, to his or her chagrin most of the time. And, you know, we don't give people any space to breathe, to think out loud, to actually change or to evolve on things. And I think that's not good for our system.
One last question for Dean Carlin from Yale University. Dean, you had mentioned earlier about how loss aversion sometimes works and sometimes doesn't in the way we think about it. Can we really predict how voters are going to react to a politician breaking their word?
Not easily. I think one thing that we do see evidence of is that there's a lot of luck is rewarded. So, you know, we know that voters do respond to the policies that are put forward, including promises, whether they can trust someone, but they also respond to just luck. You know, governors do better in states in the election returns when factors that they have no control over do well for the economy, and then that leads to higher voter voting for them. So there's lots of things that voters are going to respond to that are, both kind of rational as well as irrational. And, you know, the question of whether a stated promise hurts them if they renege on it is going to obviously depend a lot on what the promise is, whether it was important to people, whether it was really believed, whether it was reneged on for good reason.
Yeah.
Well,
Dean Carlin, a professor of economics at Yale University, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Scott McLennan, I'll give you the last word on this because we have about a minute or so left. I mean, do you think at the end of the day that we are going to hold politicians increasingly accountable for these things for the reasons Paul just mentioned? Because we have all this record. We can always poke holes in what people have said because we're watching them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Well, Paul is absolutely right about the media environment and the partisan environment that we currently have. American politics is increasingly putting a premium not on the ability to make promises, but how to break promises. This is as old as Machiavelli's The Prince, right? The prince needs to know not how to make promises, but when to break the promise and how to break the promise so that those who are promised might be able to excuse them. And this is in very short supply these days, given our political environment, given the system that we have. So I think one of the things that I hope comes out of discussions like this is a better understanding of by people in public life that it is necessary quite often to break your promise, and knowing how to do it the right way is probably the most important political skill we need right now.
Scott McLean teaches political science at Quinnipiac University. Thanks so much for coming in, Scott. I appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure.
I also want to thank Paul Orsulak, who's a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore. He's founder and principal of West Wing Writers. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Paul, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chad. It was such a pleasure.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to Anna Novak for handling the phones today. We'll be back to talk about turtles in the program tomorrow, and I promise you it will be a very interesting program. This is Where We Live.